And the Oakland meditation group, the SRF group, was by far and away the most dynamic, because Kamala, of course, had a wonderful devoted spirit, and she was so sweet and devotional, and it was just a wonderful meditation group. But her health was failing, and so she quit. She retired. And Swami said overnight, it went from being the best to being nothing at all. And it was because it was her spirit. And so after a tremendous committed effort on Swami's part to replace people with systems, he totally accepted the fact that it doesn't work. It's just as simple as that. It doesn't work. That the people are the reality. And he also came to what he says here, that if the people have the right spirit, any system will work because they will act it out with the right spirit. And if the people have the wrong spirit, he said, no system will work because they'll act it out with the wrong consciousness and they'll make it something petty and oppressive or useless in one way or another. So all through the years of Ananda, Swamiji has always put primary emphasis on people's energy and attitudes. If the attitudes are right, then everything else will follow. He tells often tells a story of many years ago of when Ananda was really in its very beginning stages, and when we used to, and you know, we just really struggled with very small amounts of money, and everything was on a near survival basis. We laugh about it now. It's not really that we have any more now, it's that we just simply go broke at a much higher level. By that, I was amused by something I read about Walt Disney. Walt Disney's, I mean, he built a big company and did many things, and by a devotee standard, lived quite comfortably. But his company was always struggling. And the building of Disneyland was an enormous indebtedness. He worked with his brother, and his brother would borrow the money and he would spend it. That was basically the system they had. And there was really never anything to spare until well after Disneyland was well underway. And then finally, but just at some very critical point in all of that, his brother called him in and just told him, we can't go on. It's just not going to work. Because Walt Disney's attitude was, don't tell me how much it costs, just tell me what the best way to do it is. And he wouldn't allow accountants at any of his creative meetings. He just wouldn't let them there. When he saw them there once or twice, he said, what are you doing in this meeting? Go away. You know, they would just decide how to do it, and then his brother would figure out how they would pay for it. But they paid for it with a huge amount of debt. So his brother was very concerned because they were so many millions and millions of dollars in debt. And so he was going to have this real serious conversation. This biography hinted but did not elaborate on the tension between the brothers from time to time. And Walt Disney, instead of getting really upset by it, just began to laugh and laugh. And he said to his brother, he said, remember when we couldn't borrow $100? And look, the bank has lent us $26 million. He said, we must be doing something right. You know. And in another context, someone said to him, you must be a very rich man. And he said, well, I owe millions of dollars, so I suppose I am. You know, the same thing. People trust me to borrow all this money. It must mean that I'm worth something. It was a sort of a different way to look at it. But Swami's attitude toward our financial situation and everything had always been, is the energy right? Is the spirit right? Because if the energy is right and the spirit is right, everything else will follow. And if the energy is wrong and the spirit is wrong, it's going to fall apart. Maybe it'll fall apart financially, probably, but it will just simply fall apart. It won't succeed. And once he'd been away for a while, and Seva gave him a report on what was happening, and Seva was the one who ran the finances, and she thought that things were pretty grim. And so she explained everything to Swami on the level of it's all pretty grim. And at the end of it, he said, but you know, the energy is wonderful, he said, so everything is fine. He was the Chinese emperor going around listening to the music. And if the music was right, he knew that the thing would work itself out. Whether every enterprise would succeed, whether we'd never have any debt, whether things would go into, would work out one way or another, was so much less important than if the energy was there, everything would follow. And he has this comment, I think it's in early on. No, he talks also about, what was it that he said? Not my thought. He was saying it's not that you don't need a system, but that systems alone never create anything. Well, that was a thought that I lost. Let me find it. Oh, I know what he was saying that I really found interesting, but he says it later. I'll wait till I get there in a moment. I also loved, don't you love where he made that comment about even after it's actually gone, the legend lives on, and the legend will live for a while. And he loves to tell that story about being in Greece at those monasteries and visiting this monastery, which he considered to be one of those spiritual mausoleums. And it was just a dead place. And then this other woman says, oh, there was so much peace there. Somebody said, well, I didn't feel any particular peace. Well, now that you mention it, she said, neither did I. But that's what I thought I was supposed to feel. And one of the things that happens that is always such a deadly element in any organization or group is that sometimes if things become so codified on the outside, then people themselves try to match themselves to the rules. You know, this is what I'm supposed to feel, this must be what I'm feeling. We had, the early years of Ananda were actually really quite wonderful in certain ways. Swamiji's leadership was almost a well-kept secret. Odd as that may sound to some of you now, even the role that he played at Ananda was simply not well known. In the beginning years, especially, he played a very stepped back role, because there were lots of people there that weren't that in tune with the real vision of Ananda, and they were sort of sorting it out, and he just didn't have the support base to really assert his position. And it was sort of like you'd be at Ananda for a while, and then you would gradually sort of sense that the grand central source of ideas and energy was somehow emanating through Swamiji. And it would be sort of like you'd say to someone, I think Swamiji's really the moving energy here, isn't he? I mean, you'd think that's an odd thing. And then someone would say, yes, but don't talk about it. Because Swami himself would just completely duck the issue. He would refuse to put himself in any kind of a recognizable leadership role beyond a very small form. And in many ways, it was the best possible way for Ananda to be organized, because there was no expectation. You just, if you tuned in to where the spiritual energy was coming from and what it meant, you did it entirely because you really felt it. And so it was really your reality. It wasn't anybody telling you what you ought to do. There was nothing to rebel against. It was you either knew it or you didn't know it. And as the years have passed, and especially more recent years, where the direct relationship between Swamiji and so many people isn't there anymore, and so you have to hear it second hand or third hand from other people being enthusiastic, and then he appears and a certain group of experienced people are so excited that he's coming that everybody else gets caught up in the excitement. But there's this thought that, oh, something spiritual is about to happen. And we try sort of to have a spiritual experience. Fortunately, much of the time his energy communicates. But I find it unfortunate that the form now precedes the experience. Because you see, it's always dangerous if the form precedes the experience, because then it at least potentially robs people of the opportunity to have their own experience. And for people who are less secure in themselves, it can even force them to pretend to have experiences they're not having, just or to affirm them just because that's what everyone, they don't want to feel left out. They want to be part of the group. It's an odd thing, isn't it? But that's why Swamiji talks so much about this. And if you even read, you know, he talks about rules and so on, but even if you read the Ananda rules of conduct for Ananda monastic members, there's not a rule in that book. If you actually read it carefully, it's all about right attitude. It's all about consciousness. There are a few recommendations. Before you make an important decision, you should consult. You know, marriage is not something that should be undertaken lightly, and you should consult. So those things you might call rules. But even then, it doesn't say, thou shalt, and if thou doesn't, this will happen to thou, or anything like that. It merely suggests that that would be a way to do it. But almost all of that, with, you know, with those tiny exceptions, it's all just describing the right attitude to have and the right consciousness to have, because that is the rule. If you have the right consciousness, then you don't have to make any other rules, because it will just follow. And it's so sweet, he also makes just the comment that, and above all, the consciousness that's needed is charity. And if you think through every sort of altercation that ever happens in a group, and wrong behavior, and wrong, if there was a charitable attitude, one toward another, and I just don't mean leaders toward the followers, but I mean also followers toward the leaders, if there's a charitable attitude, a kindness, a willing to be supportive and forgiving, and to be generous in the way that you respond, generous on many levels, generous financially, generous in your heart, generous in your acceptance of people, generous in what you're willing to put up with, all of that, a charitable attitude, then everything runs very easily. And it's when there isn't a charitable attitude that everything gets very difficult. I remember many years ago in the early years of Ananda that before many of us were very experienced with human nature. One man who was quite prominent, who because of this story hasn't been with us for decades, very nice man, but flawed. He did some exceedingly irresponsible things. There was no way to measure it by any standard, no matter how kindly you measure it. It was very bad judgment on his part. As it happened, Swamiji was in India, and a few overzealous individuals, as Swami said, went after a gnat with a baseball bat and just did not have a charitable attitude. You know, and unfortunately created so much chaos that this individual got derailed for a really long time. But it wasn't a matter of system or anything like that. It was just wrong consciousness. That's really what wiped it out. But right consciousness always saves it. And he was also saying, he was also really trying to talk about the fact that there's no inspiration in the form of something. Just to say this is how we do it doesn't in itself create any spark. And he uses the example of how many artists can be trained in techniques, but only a few of them have the inspiration to really become artists, because it's not the technique that really makes you an artist. You may have to learn the technique, but the technique alone is just the mechanism that allows you to express inspiration if you have it. And it's just the same in organizations. And he's also just really trying to say, because he's trying to use this as a handbook to encourage people to found communities, don't spend all your time figuring out in great detail how every little thing happens. When people would ask me in those early years, well, what do you do about arguments and disagreements and things like that? And I would answer, it just doesn't come up. And I think people oftentimes just didn't think I was telling the truth. And I didn't say that people are always nice or that people never have disagreements. But we don't have to have a system for settling them. We don't have to have this elaborate system. I mean, my God, people have such elaborate systems. Then four come together and six arbitrate, and then three do this, and then seven more do that, and then these 16 will decide what those four shall do. And, you know, just people sit up late at night and just spin out all these things. It's very common. But at Ananda, we have none of that. We've never needed it, because we have an attitude of look first to yourself, an attitude of meditation, an attitude of attuning yourself to God, an attitude of feeling that if there's disharmony outside, then I have to think about my own inner harmony first. And all of that solves problems, because there's true inspiration in that. Swami says also, interestingly, insofar as any of the existing monasteries that have these really rigid rules laid out actually have vitality, it's to the extent to which the individuals in them are still connected to the founders. And they still be, he says it, he's so brilliant in the way he says it. The founders had sufficient magnetism that they are able to project it even forward all these centuries. You know, you can still tune into their consciousness. St. Teresa, St. Clair, St. Francis are the ones he expresses. So that individuals can find inspiration, and then when they act out the form, they're not acting it out as a form, they're acting it out from the inspiration. And he mentions the story of the end of Francis's life, when Francis's work solidified and died while he was still alive. It was a most amazing experience for him to have to live through. He had done it entirely through spirit and through inspiration, but then Brother Elias, who Shivani told me recently, is actually not considered to be such a traitor by the Franciscans themselves. It's only people like us who think he's a total traitor. But he came in, and while Francis was still there, and he just began to pull it all into rules. And Francis was there, and they wanted, Francis's first rule for the Franciscan order was imitate Jesus and depend on God. That was about it. And so now it's toward the end of his life, and there's hundreds or thousands of brothers, and there's the Clares and everyone, and they want him to do something more appropriate. They've been recognized by the Pope. He's recognized as a saint. There's just this huge Franciscan movement, and all they still have is this little, you know, bit of a rule. So they asked him to write it out again. So he went into meditation in a cave, and he prayed deeply, and he came back with this love poem to God and this exhortation to the brothers and the sisters to always love God wholeheartedly and devote themselves with complete faith and absolute surrender. Just throw yourself into the hands of God. And Elias said, maybe you could try again. So Francis tried again. And he went back and he went into seclusion and he came out with the same thing again. He did it at least twice. He might have done it three times. And then what happened, literally what happened, is they lost it and they wrote another one. Yeah, they did. By this point, Francis himself had resigned. He resigned from the order at a certain point. He resigned from his own order. I mean, he remained a brother, but he resigned from being the head of the order. He resigned when he came back from the Crusades and discovered that they had built this huge building to be something for the Franciscans. They had built this huge building. He saw the building, Francis did. He went up on the roof, and with his bare hands, he tried to rip it down. He started ripping the roof tiles off and throwing them onto the ground. And he was so horrified to see what they had done with what he had established. But after that, he realized that it wasn't for him to do. I mean, who knows what he thought inside himself about whatever state of consciousness had come upon him that he climbed onto the building and tried to rip the tiles off. I think he also saw, quite realistically, that it was beyond him to influence, that he had spawned the child and the child was now having its own reality. He just became a simple brother again and just said, I will just lead by example. And then he just let them have it after that. A very strange story in a certain way. Sometimes you'll hear in the Ananda context, somebody will make comment about so-and-so as sort of an Elias. And what that means is somebody who comes in and acts like they're really with you, but in fact have such a different concept that they're really destroying what you're doing. I mean, it's not necessarily an Elias to us, but just sort of an Elias, someone who, because Elias was always full of praise for Francis and, you know, very, Shivani mentioned to me that he has a grave of honor up somewhere in Assisi because he's considered a great hero of their order. But odd, isn't it, how things work? But you see the predilection to think that systems are real and that you can't. The whole argument with the Francis order was they used to just convene with no plans, no food, no plans, no shelter. They would just rely on God. And the first time they had a really huge convocation, which was like about 5,000 brothers, Francis still had enough influence to refuse to make any plans at all. And others were saying, well, it's one thing when there's 100 or 50 of us, but with 5,000 you must plan, and he refused. And then all the neighborhood mobilized and brought everything they needed to them. But no one had the faith after that to be able to do it, or necessarily the power. It's just the way things work, isn't it? But what Swami's trying to say to us, let us learn from that and just come back to it. And it's interesting, he also mentions the Constitution of the United States as being one of the most perfect forms that you can create. And in fact, everyone who studies it, it's a beautiful document. But even that is being completely destroyed in its spirit and its application by both the courts and the legislature over the years now. I mean, the kind of court decisions that are coming down are so contrary to any common sense understanding of what was intended, and yet they're all justified on the basis of the same document, which is to say once the spirit is lost, then even the ideas that come, they're all confused. They just, this is the idea that I thought was so marvelous that Swami wrote here, and I've read it over quite a few times because I've observed this over the years at Ananda. He talks about having recognized experts. Experts in what you're doing is not always such an asset. He was being very specific about communities. Oftentimes through the years of Ananda, this has been a phenomenon I've watched. And again, Swami's articulated things that we've just observed and know to be true, which is people will come who are very good at something that we need as a community. But whenever we see such people coming, it has always made us kind of nervous, because it has almost never worked. And partly we've figured it out for many different levels and come up with different little ideas about how it is. Even so much so that sometimes if somebody comes with a real skill, this was when we were just primarily one ashram up in Nevada City. Here it's different because people tend to keep their professions. They'll come live at Ananda, but they'll just keep their job. So it's a different thing. Ananda Village is an ashram of a more classical type where you step in and whatever you were doing, you leave behind and you embrace the whole ashram lifestyle.